when a company gets started, right, you have an owner and a founder, and somebody has this great idea and starts this business and ultimately hires a few people to kind of go on that journey with them. The first thing that they do when they want to share the wealth is they have a profit sharing plan. If they make money, they give a small piece of that to everybody else who helped make money.
Welcome to the Executive Compensation Podcast. On this show, we discuss all aspects of executive compensation. Whether you're a compensation committee member, a seasoned compensation professional, or just curious to learn more about executive compensation, then this show is the answer. Each episode brings you a focused and actionable interview on specific topics of executive compensation. This episode is brought to you by Meridian Compensation Partners. Meridian works with compensation committees to ensure the most effective processes are in place to go beyond mere compliance with governance requirements and create healthy, dynamic relationships between the board, management, and its advisors. Meridian helps boards use compensation to attract and retain critical talent and to make informed business decisions that will link pay and performance, drive business results, increase shareholder value, and mitigate potential risks. Learn more at meridiancp.com. Welcome again to another episode of the Executive Compensation Podcast. Today, very excited to have Jared Berman and Jamie McGough of Meridian Compensation Partners here on the episode to talk really about what we can be doing better with executive pay. So Jared and Jamie, thank you both for coming on here. To kick things off, you know, what are we going to be talking about today?
Jared and I, from time to time, would just challenge each other about how can we be better as individual professionals or as a profession? What is it that we are all doing, maybe out of habit, that maybe is not the best or maybe not always fitting? So we, from time to time, we'll toss around ideas of what seems to be working with our clients or with us as professionals and what could be better. And so this is really an outgrowth of that. What issues do we see and how could we improve our craft?
And so what are some of the common problems that you are seeing in executive compensation?
And of course, these are not always applicable, but I think there's three or four things that Jared and I commonly will talk about. One is a kind of excessive degree of uniformity. There's a lot of homogeneity out there, right? A lot of similarity in programs and their design and performance shares and restricted shares and the weightings and 50th percentile market philosophies. And these can be good things, but there's not a lot of variation. And this is would seem at least suggest to us, is this healthy? Is this the best thing? It seems to squash innovation and energy sometimes, and it's okay to be different. What it seems to subsume is don't stick your head above the corn. Don't be different. And that's not always good. Sometimes it's beneficial to be different. A couple other items. One is there's this trend towards anything that's valuable or anything that's important should be put inside the incentive plans. The incentive plans are repositories for everything that's important. This is not true. Incentive plans are a blunt instrument. They're good for certain things and they're not so good for certain things. And so not everything that's important should go in the incentive plan. And so using incentive plans for what they are good at and for a few things we find is probably more beneficial than allowing them to become too complicated. A couple others. Very importantly, the short-term incentive plan. This plan for executives takes on a very high prominence, very high perceived value. Just a couple of data points. Usually short-term incentives are something like 30% of an executive's target total comp, or in long-term incentives is probably something like 50 to 80, depending on the size of the company. You would think it's reverse. The amount of time spent on the measures and the goal setting and the process and the back and forth would suggest that short-term incentives is much more prominent than it is, but it does capture a lot of people's attention. This is not necessarily healthy. And we'll talk about it in a little bit more depth in a bit, but there's a very consistent trend line across industries and companies. And so the flip side is true. This element to pay long-term incentives, which does have a far higher weighting by the numbers, doesn't get nearly the attention as short-term incentives do. So to summarize, a lot of uniformity, some loss of focus about the use of incentive plans, a very high prominence in short-term incentives that might be outsized, and a lower than desirable prominence of long-term incentives.
Yeah, and Jamie, I think one other that I might add too is kind of the reliance on benchmarking data and kind of the focal point that most boards and definitely executives have on kind of what is market, what are the 15 other peers closest to them getting paid, what is the next CEO that's coming in the door getting. And I think all of that is directly tied to the few topics you brought up, which is kind of the allocation of compensation to our three traditional buckets and making sure that everything is median or better, which is all kind of perpetuating some of these challenges that we have.
One thing I'll say too is, this is not a blame game. This is not to say, oh, these are the devils that make us do this. There's responsibility for this from all quarters. This is, again, just about how can we be better? How can we be alert to circumstances which suggest a different path might be better? That's all.
And so how did we end up getting here, where we are with all these kind of trends and problems at the moment?
Yeah, I think, Jake, to kind of walk through that one, I might take us on a little walk down memory lane. I've been doing this for about 20 years now, and I came into this field really at the tail end of stock options, right after the late 90s, early 2000s, where we had the tech bubble and companies were giving out stock options to all employees, no matter, you know, where you were in the organization. People were seeing significant amounts of paper wealth through stock options. Some of that got destroyed when the bubble burst and people saw the markets recorrect themselves and saw a lot of options underwater for the first time in many years. But really, the change in accounting rules was step one to how we got here. Once companies had to expense stock options, that really opened Pandora's box for looking at other vehicles, whether that's salary, bonus, or really other types of equity instruments, really primarily, to say, are options now the best vehicle now that they're not free, in quotes? And I think that was really kind of the start of all of this right around the time of Sarbanes-Oxley and some of the Enron and other issues that we had. It kind of reframed executive pay and the landscape of the programs. If you kind of fast forward a few more years, and we got to the next downturn, if you want to call it the 08, 09 downturn, and ultimately kind of what became Dodd-Frank, we really got this new focus on say on pay. And these proxy advisors, both ISS and Glass Lewis, to name the two biggest ones, really started to put pressure on companies on what programs should look like, not what they did look like, but what they should look like according to their rules and their procedures and their evaluation to help guide companies and investors in evaluating whether these were good programs, not good programs, or companies doing the right thing. That really led to this kind of focal shift to homogeneous programs that Jamie mentioned, where now all of a sudden, for better or worse, we all thought that relative shareholder return was the metric to use, and that three-year performance plans had to be the vehicle that we had to focus on, and that bonuses had to fit into this box of metrics and opportunities and maximums of 200%. So that really kind of was the next driver of that. And I think if you fast forward over the past, call it 5 to 10 years, and certainly kind of the COVID pandemic and some of the changes we saw throughout 2020 and 21 really kind of gave this life, was this focal point for directors on say on pay. We've seen a shift in board member composition. We've seen kind of the now professional board member. We've seen that role really kind of change and redefine. And now failing say on pay is really perceived as a horrible thing. And I think a lot of companies want to avoid failing say on pay, or at least avoid getting against recommendations from ISS and Glass Lewis to the best extent possible. And doing something that goes against the grain, doing something that is going to open you up to criticism, has now taken on a completely different light that has kind of caused us to get back into this box of kind of what is normal, what is traditional, what is everybody else doing.
And there are examples, even this most recent proxy season, if we go through, I would say it's never one size fits all, but the common theme for many companies that got against vote recommendations from ISS is one-time grants. Now, I'm not here to defend every one-time grant. Each case is its own circumstances. In fact, that's maybe our fundamental argument, innovation and tailoring. But why are one-time grants so bad? They might be in certain circumstances. Maybe they're very healthy. You're motivating a team to do very specific things under very specific circumstances, and we want to accent the upside or retention risks or whatever the facts and circumstances might be. But there's a very high correlation between one-time grants and against vote recommendations. This, again, quells innovation and tailoring of, compensation is a tool. It's a tool to do very specific things that a compensation committee for executives is going to apply to try to achieve certain objectives. And so there's no one size fits all. And there are circumstances to be different, to differentiate yourself, to address a particular problem. And forcing things through a filter like that is just, it's not healthy.
And this is super helpful to understand kind of like how we got here and all this context and everything. And so what are some of the fundamental challenges we're seeing today as a result of all this?
Yeah, I would say, Jake, there's really, in my mind, really two fundamental challenges. And as Jamie and I advise our clients and we kind of see how the compensation committee calendar goes around the year and where we spend our time, the two things that I think probably make this the biggest challenge and probably the reason why Jamie and I are here talking about this today are as follows. One is the constant renegotiation of pay levels that goes on in an organization every single year, right? This chasing of the market, as we tried to describe a few moments ago, where you can have boards and management teams that are very harmonious, all marching towards a great long-term strategy, and it becomes divisive. This one time a year, right in January, February, March, when we have the Super Bowl of meetings, as we call it, and we're constantly renegotiating pay annually, even though there was an employment contract several years ago, even though we take a look at market data very regularly, and we all know kind of the flaws with some of that market data and kind of the year-over-year volatility, it's that one time a year that it really opens up that renegotiation that creates this tension and conflict that's really unnecessary. Because people are, generally speaking, paid fairly and paid well for what they do. And most programs are generally aligned with performance, you know, to the extent that companies measure that and want to achieve that. I think the other one is what Jamie mentioned earlier, and this is probably the biggest one, which is the disproportionate amount of time spent on the goal setting of both short-term and long-term plans. And let me elaborate a little bit on that. Fundamentally, if you think about a board of directors' fiduciary responsibility, they are elected by their shareholders to represent all of the stakeholders of the company, but primarily the shareholders of the company. And they are primarily measured through success on whether or not the share price has gone up or not, or whether they've beaten others like them, or the market or an index like them or not. But yet we've, in executive comp, really kind of shied away from this kind of stock option, value creation, did our shareholders win mentality? And we've now moved to incentive plans that are really focused on 1 and 3 year financial goals that management teams would argue are, if they achieve those things, they should create value. They should result in value creation. And so what do? We end up having to work in a constant negotiation of what is budget, what is acceptable performance, what's possible performance, what can the economy and the macroeconomic events around you allow for performance? And inevitably, right, if you think about it, Jake, the same people who are presenting the goals, the same people who are lobbying for threshold targets and maximums, the same people who have the greatest line of sight into what their business can achieve are the exact people who are going to either be rewarded or penalized from the achievement of those goals. That's the truth, right? So we now have the CEO, the CFO, other operational leaders, all setting budget for a plan that they're all going to get paid for. And whose job is it to approve it? It's the audit committee and the compensation committee and ultimately the board of directors. These are folks that come to meetings 4, 5, 6 times a year. Maybe they have some other phone calls. These are people who are representatives to advocate for the shareholders that they are elected by. But they don't have the direct line of sight into the business to know what is the art of possible. They don't have all of the ins and outs of what is coming at these companies, but yet it is their job to say, yes, this is a good threshold. This is a good target. This is a good max. And ultimately that was good or bad performance relative to the other factors. When really what we should be focused on is, did the management team create value? Did shareholders win? Did the stock price go up? Did it beat others that were similarly impacted by all those events? Not necessarily, did you hit a budget? And did you make enough adjustments and in an adjusted metric to hit budget, but did you create value?
We've got to be clear. We're not impugning anybody's integrity. Any person put in the circumstances that Jared just described is going to behave this way. We want to set goals that we can achieve. Of course, we want to be rewarded. Nobody wants to set a particular budget or a set of goals and fail miserably. And they want to be honest with their board members. So this is not about people lacking integrity, not in the least. We're just simply saying, is this process, is this ideal? We all talk about aligning management with shareholders. This, of course, makes a lot of sense. But is this how owners behave? Is this what an owner would do? And so again, in the spirit of self-reflection, we're participants in this process and say, is this, maybe there are circumstances, not all, but maybe there are circumstances where this ordinary process is not the one we follow.
Yeah, and Jamie, I think that point really should be described one more time, because I think that was a key point. You know, sometimes we hear the word sandbagging. This isn't really about accusing anybody of sandbagging or not sandbagging. This really is about the position we're putting management teams in to actually set goals that they and their whole entire organizations are going to get rewarded for. And Jake, I always try to kind of think back to like when a company gets started, right? You have an owner and a founder and somebody has this great idea and starts this business and ultimately hires a few people to kind of go on that journey with them. The first thing that they do when they want to share the wealth is they have a profit sharing plan. If they make money, they give a small piece of that to everybody else who helped make money. We then outgrow that, right? All of a sudden the revenues are too big, the EBIT's too big, the profit's too big, and the pool gets too large. And we start to say, now, how can we do this better? And that's when we get into this kind of goal setting kind of box that we're in, this paradigm that we're in. But we all started as, you know, owners of our business who want to make money and ultimately share a piece of that with the people that helped us make money. The question is, can we get back there even as a multiple thousands of employee organization, a multi-billion dollar organization? Can we get back to that mentality where we are all trying to create value and ultimately share some of that value with the people that are helping achieve those goals?
Yeah, I love this mindset and the way you guys are kind of thinking about this differently. And you know, so what are some of the alternatives and some principles people could follow if they were trying to do this differently?
Yeah. So I'll describe the broad contours of it. And first of all, say is, this is not for every circumstance. This is not a cookbook. In fact, again, this is our principal argument here, is more tailoring, more innovation, more customization would be a healthy thing. So that's the first thing. Second, what we're trying to do with the structure I'll describe is create a true owner mindset. That if you, whoever you happen to be, were the owner of this business, is this how you would behave, or how do we want you to behave as if you were the true owner of the business? Create a true long-term orientation. And the first thing, let's talk about cash compensation. Most times cash compensation, again, for an executive population, it's salary plus a target bonus. And you might get less than the target bonus, you might earn the target bonus, or you might get more than that, depending on performance versus the goals. First suggestion would be collapse these together. Take the target bonus dollar amount, add it to the existing salary and say, this is now your current, call it new salary. So we don't have a debate about cutting people's cash compensation amounts they probably live on, right? That's your new salary, all right? So we're not even, but the short-term incentive plan goes away. It's gone. This would be, by the way, for a very select group of people, right? This is not for the whole company or not everybody who's in a bonus plan, but probably 5 to 10 people. Could be more, could be less, depending upon the company, but it's a select group of people. You have a model like I'm describing. So the bonus plan goes away. We take the target bonus dollar value, we add it to their existing salary and say, that's your cash compensation. That's part one. Part two, we're no longer going to make annual long-term incentive grants of typically performance shares and RSUs. Now we're going to make 4 or 5 years worth of equity grants right now. Part options, part restricted shares. Right now we have given you a compelling equity stake in the company. We're no longer occupying your time on short-term goal setting. Now, in fact, we've divorced your goal setting from the pay altogether. Now, when you're setting the business goals in the context of another purpose, what's the purpose? Long-term value. Now your mindset has shifted materially towards someone as if you own the company. In fact, you do have a substantial stake in the company. You are an owner, much more material. And essentially the committee message has been, here is a huge equity stake. Go create a bunch of value. We're going to give you 5 years worth of equity grants. We're going to back end load the vesting 3 to 5, say years 3 through 5. There's no interim equity grants in between. Just go create a bunch of value. Your orientation, your mindset as an executive team has been completely altered. You're not focused on the short-term goals for purposes of the bonus plan. The bonus plan is gone. You're focused on goal setting for what can we do to create a long-term value trajectory for the company. Again, this is not for every company. It's not for every circumstance. It's not for every person in the organization. We'll come to these in a few moments. But it is for a senior leadership team to reorient itself towards long-term value.
Yeah, Jamie, that's really well said. And kind of if you build on that a little bit, all of our plans have become short-term in nature, whether it's an annual bonus plan or a biannual bonus plan, or even our long-term incentive plans. We use that word, long-term incentive plans. It is now effectively a three-year finite period granted every single year with overlapping cycles, right? It's nothing more than a bunch of annual plans all kind of lumped together to kind of form a three-year view. That's not really long-term, Jake, in the way I think others used to think of long-term. Stock options used to have a 10-year life to really get people to focus on kind of the value that can be created over a 10-year span. I once talked to a CEO of a large manufacturing company. He said, from my idea and greenfield idea to actually implementing and seeing some returns of that idea is a 10-year period, not a three-year period. So if you can take an executive, take a CEO, take a CFO out of the mindset of how do I deploy capital in this 12-month period to maximize my margin this year or to maximize my returns this year, but instead say, what can I invest in today that might pay dividends in years 5, year 7, year 10, or year 15, and really change that mindset and that paradigm to actually focus on the long-term value creation is really powerful. And the other piece that we had talked about a little bit earlier, which was it really changes the responsibility of who's now driving those behaviors and who's holding people accountable for this, right? Right now, it's the compensation committee that is responsible for approving goals. It's the compensation committee and the audit committee for approving adjustments to performance. The compensation committee is responsibility for determining the payout. What if you changed that paradigm and said, Mr. or Miss CEO, you are in charge of this company. You have the greatest vision into all of the workings, all the levers you can pull, all the different business units you can focus on, all the business units you could sell because they're not actually creating value. They might just be using up some of our cash. What would you hold people accountable now if we changed the focus to be value creation? What goal would you actually require of them if you're not part of the plan that is set based on that goal? Would you require a little bit more profit this year? Would you require an extra 100 basis points of margin expansion? Is the realm of possible better or bigger than what you are kind of hedging, for lack of a better word, in your normal plan? And now the compensation committee, these board members who are there a few times a year, don't have to be responsible for that. It's the CEO, CFO, business unit leaders who are in the details every day that are now really going to be able to drive better results and hold people really accountable for things that they need to create value.
And if you think about it, every investor in a public company, from the smallest retail investor to the largest institutions, is interested in one thing and one thing only: value creation. That is the end, which is stock price appreciation and dividends. Now, if you're using restricted stock and options, there's no goals, no measures defined. You basically have turned it over to management and say, if you need to have higher returns on capital to create value, that's what you should do. If you need to have higher growth to have greater value creation, that's what you should do. If it should be margin expansion, that's what you should do. If it should be market share, essentially they're saying, you are the management team. Use the criteria that you think are most correlated with, most important for the long-term purpose of value creation, dividends and price appreciation. And you have aligned them with the interests of their owners and all the things associated with building and sustaining a business for long-term value creation. There are lots of pieces that get to value creation, but you're rewarding them for value creation. That's why options and RSUs, you're rewarding them for the end, what they're most obligated to deliver, which is value.
I know we have the ability, Jake, to ramble on this and kind of keep plugging away, but I mean, there's two other kind of scenarios that, you know, Jamie and I deal with our clients all the time, right? The first is M&A, both the acquisition side, but also the divestiture side, right? Both of those two things have the ability to very quickly create or destroy value, both. And when a company spends capital, large sums of capital to acquire a company, the first question is, what's the impact to my incentive plans? I set these goals a couple of years ago, and now all of a sudden, you know, if I use return on invested capital, my denominator got huge, but my return and my numerator didn't get that big right away because it takes time to kind of put those businesses together, even though I had to deploy a lot of capital up front. How do I adjust that out? Or I want to diversify and sell part of a business that's an underperforming asset. Well, now I got to go and change all those goals to recognize I'm not going to get the EBIT from that business anymore. And it's going to change my margin profile and it's going to affect every other metric, right? These are things that should just naturally be done because they're going to ultimately create long-term value or save some value that's being destroyed, quite frankly, by some of these businesses that shouldn't be around anymore or be in the portfolio anymore. The second thing is kind of all of the adjustments that happen in these programs, whether that's commodity price, supply chain disruption, the war in Ukraine, COVID-19, you name it, right? All of those things, and currency, not to mention another one that we talk about all the time, right? All of those things, it's just noise now, right? Your shareholders don't get paid when you don't deliver because of supply chain disruptions. Your shareholders don't get paid when the currency goes against you and you've decided to invest in your heavily in a geography that currency got destroyed, right? All of those things are part of management's decision on where should I operate? Where's it affordable? Where's the best labor for talent? Where's the cheapest cost of labor? Where can I get my supply the best? How can I distribute my goods the easiest to keep my cost down, right? That's all part of the equation. And by avoiding the parsing out of all of those things, we've now just kind of boiled it down to what Jamie said, which is, did you create value? Because there's lots of levers that an executive has to pull every day and every month and every year to figure out how to create value. That's what the name of this game is.
Just like any hypothetical owner of an enterprise who's not focused on goal setting for their bonus at the end of the year, they're pulling 100 different levers in any day of the week for a long-term value of the organization, long-term profitability of the organization.
Out of a lot of these conversations we have about this, this makes a lot of sense. So I love what you guys are talking about here. And I think one thing that people would be looking at is, you know, are there any precedents to something like this? Is there any companies that have tried or incorporated these type of incentive plans versus kind of a lot what we talked about at the beginning here as the standards?
Yeah, Jake. I mean, I think, you know, the first precedent that comes to mind is any private equity investment ever, right? I mean, if you think about kind of how a normal PE shop incentivizes their teams, right? They come in, they buy a business, and they have an objective, right? Their objective is to turn it around, create value, and ultimately dispose of that asset within 5 to 7 to 10 years, whatever the time is. And the first thing that they do is they find a team that can accomplish their goals. They pay them some cash to get them in the door, to get them to be able to live. And they give them a big chunk of equity, right? I mean, the most common kind of one is they take 10% of the company, they'll leave that off of the management team, they'll give the CEO 3 to 5 points of that, they'll give the CFO another 1 to 2 points, and they kind of whittle it down, they leave a little reserve for the people that are coming in years 2, 3, and 4, and they say, go. And either they create value and they're able to dispose of that, you know, asset through an IPO or sale or some other form of capitalization and liquidity event, and everybody wins, or they don't. And the people then just got their cash to live and they didn't make this pot of gold at the end of the rainbow because they weren't able to accomplish the ultimate goal of creating value and selling it. That's kind of the first kind of model where I think a lot of this kind of comes in because there's a lot of similarities there with those two things. The second is, and Jamie said this really well, and I know we'll talk in a moment about some other challenges with this type of design because it's not perfect and it's not for everybody, but I have been able to implement this personally at a company with a shareholder or two that have a large stake in the company, right? So it's not a completely diversified retail-based oriented share base, right? Where everybody owns fractions of shares, but there's a concentration of shares either with a private equity firm or family or an original owner, right? Who has this long-term mentality of, I want this company to be in my portfolio for a very long time to come. And I'm not worried about the little ebbs and flows in the market price every 6 months, every quarter, when you hit EPS goals or don't hit EPS goals. It's really about how can we create long-term sustained value and actually grow this into something meaningful. When somebody has that mentality on the board and that mentality in the shareholder base, it makes some of the other things that we talked about easier, right? Say on pay is still important, but it's not necessarily the most important thing. The board members that are brought in to have a shared mentality of, yes, oversight and governance, but also how do we create this long-lasting value-created enterprise, not brought in for a 3-year, 5-year stint to just manage the business and kind of get through the checklist of charter things. So you need to have the right ownership structure. You need to have the right board members with the right amount of courage, and you need to have the right executive team who wants to sign up for something PE-like without being in a PE shop.
What we described is not the only thing. There are hybrids to this where you could maintain some of the short-term incentive plan, but still have the levered up equity. But we're just trying to outline here that what we think are the principal areas of limitations of what we commonly do, and that deserve to be examined from time to time under certain circumstances, say there's an alternative here that might work better.
And so what would some of the challenges be if someone actually did want to go down this approach? You know, like what are some of the pitfalls or issues they could have with that?
Yeah, there's probably a few that stand out. Jared and I will kind of tag team this. There's internal challenges and there's some external ones. From an internal point of view, first thing that comes to mind is there might be a potential disconnect between the senior most group that's going to have this very novel approach and other management or even lower level employees that commonly participate in the short-term incentive plan. Are we going to do it for them too? The answer is no. It doesn't fit for them given the what the breadth of decision-making responsibility they might have and what the the marketplace circumstances might be. So from a practical point of view, you may still need business goals that you're going to establish for the short-term incentive plan for this next echelon of employees. But again, the senior management team by assumption would be divorced from that. So their setting of those goals would be in the context of what is the business need, what we want to achieve in the coming year, but in a full business context, not because they have a stake in the outcome of that particular outcome, right? So they're trying to set them more objectively, but you still might have a bonus plan. It might even be as broad as a profit sharing plan, akin to what Jared was referring to before. You have a bonus plan that is competitive, delivers bonus opportunities to people that's consistent with the marketplace. It still might exist. But it now would be in management's hands. It wouldn't even have to be a compensation committee effort because it's no longer involving the senior most officers. So essentially, it's a part of the management process. Go set some goals that you think is going to motivate your people and is consistent with long-term value. So it becomes a much more streamlined process. There's the psychological part of the internal, which could be there's going to have to be a message to people that, hey, we haven't become divorced from you as our fellow employees. We're still wanted. This is a bigger team. So even though we may be paid somewhat differently, I want them to understand, hey, there's still business objectives we need to achieve as a group, right? So understanding that while we have different pay arrangements, as they do now to a certain extent, doesn't mean that we have different objectives as an organization, as a team. You just have to make the extra effort to do that.
Yeah, and Jake, you know, so Jamie focused a bit on some of the internal dynamics, you know, of what needs to be addressed when you're kind of separating kind of now kind of executives and everybody else and having different compensation schemes, which we would argue they already have to some degree already with the different pay mixes that are in place and the different vehicles that we use. But externally, this has created some potential challenges as well. And I started to allude to this, right? I mean, say on pay is still here. It is still important. The proxy advisors are still going to potentially criticize something like this. We know that ISS and Glassnode in particular do not like mega grants. They do not like upfront things that are outside of the normal plan, right? They like consistent messaging of programs and really consistent opportunities. So if you think about, you know, as Jamie said, you know, 70% of a CEO's pay package is already tied to equity. And now we're going to take that and we're going to grant 5 years worth of that equity up front. That's a big number. And that's a big number that, according to their models, will fail say on pay every time, right? No amount of performance in the year of grant, because of the way that they quantify those things, will get you over the say on pay hurdle. So really, it requires a board, it requires a compensation committee that believes philosophically that this is the right thing to do. They're committed to this approach because this cannot be we're in halfway, we're out halfway, we're in this year, but we're out next year. I mean, you need to have some sort of commitment to this approach. And you need to recognize that you may take some heat in that first year, especially from the proxy advisors, because it doesn't fit their model. And so you need to be able to feel very confident that your explanation to your shareholders of why you're doing this and what you hope to achieve from this is the right message and ultimately will deliver on the results, either that executives will get paid very, very well for delivering, or they won't, because those stock options can easily be underwater if they underperform and they don't create value. And ultimately, you need to continue to communicate that pay for performance alignment and orientation down the road.
I think that courage part can't be understated. Yes, it requires courage to be able to face the criticism you're going to get at the front end. That's true. But then it also means you have to prove yourself. As Jared said, once we do this, it can't be, oh, it's a little bit harder than we thought. And they decided we're going to make some normal equity grants anyways. You have to be committed to the approach that we're going to give people a big stake now and that's it. And then we're gonna commit to this for a number of years.
And Jake, just a couple other, maybe not necessarily specifically internal or external bucket, but some other things that I think companies who are considering this or want to talk about this should be aware of. I mean, these are things that Jamie and I, when we're having late night conversations about kind of what this could look like, we kind of rattle off as things we have to be aware of, right? This can create unintended consequences. Like, let's not make a mistake about that. If you give somebody a large amount of equity and you say the best way to get paid on that equity is to create value, one way to create a premium is to sell your organization, right? And we know CEO by themselves cannot sell a company, but they can certainly position their company for a potential sale. And we know that a change in control is a quick way and maybe an easier type of way to get a deal premium and to then ultimately cash out on this vehicle. So I think one unintended consequence we have to be aware of is kind of that kind of innate desire to sell in order to get accelerated on this vehicle and to get a premium on this vehicle. Another question, you know, that we always wrestle with is kind of termination not for cause, termination by good reason, whatever kind of death and disability, I mean, whatever termination you want to put in there, or retirement for that matter, how are you going to treat this vehicle? We've now effectively accelerated 3, 5, 7 years of grants up front. So what happens when somebody is terminated down the road? Really be very thoughtful about, you know, what that means to the estate, what that means to the family, and what they're going to be entitled to over that time period that they otherwise would not have had we had the more traditional paradigm of compensation. Another one, we know sorry, go ahead, please.
Sorry, Jared. Any of these that Jared rightly identifies, they are subjects that would have to be addressed. None of them are so overwhelming that they're insurmountable. These are design provisions that companies contend with all the time. Treatment on change of control, treatment of various forms of termination. These are solvable problems, depending on the fact that a company can design into the program.
Yeah. And Jake, may I just give one or two more? And I know we're probably running short on time here, but as you can tell, we're pretty passionate about these topics. You know, another one is, you know, how do you add people kind of mid-cycle or midstream, right? We know management teams are not static. We know people are going to come in and out of these programs. So really being thoughtful about how do we add people throughout the program, I think is something to be aware of. And lastly, you know, one of the biggest things that this type of paradigm creates is retention. I mean, we talk about retention of talent all the time. Is there any better retention vehicle potentially out there than a big slug of equity that vests over a longer period of time and has some significant value opportunity at play, right? And it changes this kind of notion of executive employment agreements that have a fixed term and then 1-year evergreen provisions that constantly just kind of keep going, to really putting a stake in the ground and saying, I want you, Mr. or Ms. CEO, to be my CEO for a 5-year period. And here's how I'm going to deliver that pay for you to earn over 5 years. That's not saying that you're not going to be CEO in year 6 to 10, but it is saying that very thoughtfully, we are not going to have this conversation for a couple of years. At year 3 or 4, right, before we get to year 5, we're going to have a conversation of, do we want to sign you up for the next 5-year stint or the next 7-year stint? So you have to be thoughtful about planning for succession planning, acknowledging that this big event will happen in year 5 and it will create this pocket of potential retention risk at that moment. But also think about, Jake, the messaging that you're sending to the next people, the people who have aspirations to be the CEO, aspirations to be the CFO, right? That next level succession plan. You're now very clearly communicating, I'm locking this person in for 5 years or 7 years. That means you need to wait 5 years or 7 years. And so that's why, you know, Jamie and I said this can't really just be a CEO program. This needs to be a management team philosophy, because we all have to be in this mindset together and then be able to move people along at the right pace, kind of every few years when we want to reevaluate these programs.
What the retention comes from another place too. Retention sometimes is about people mitigating risks to their current life circumstances. They have younger children, maybe they have kids going to college, whatever it is, they want to have some stability. Notice what we've done with your cash compensation. We've eliminated the variability in your cash compensation. That big slug that was previously the target bonus, that's not part of your salary. Right. So your salary went from whatever it is, X, add the target bonus, and now it's here. It doesn't change. Well, it might change according to the normal merit process, but we're not, it's no longer a variable element in the regular cash compensation that you're expecting to live on. We've eliminated that variability. So the retention comes in that regard as well. So I might just kind of wrap this up. This started off with, how can we be better? How can we be better as professionals? How can we be better as a profession? And it's always good to step back and say, hey, what are we doing just by habit? And sometimes habits are good and we should repeat them. Sometimes they deserve to be examined. And being innovative, being different in some circumstances makes sense. And this excessive attention to not sticking out is not necessarily healthy.
This is absolutely incredible. I think this is, you guys opened, I think, a lot of like eyes to this and looking at it differently. So I appreciate you guys taking the time to come on here. Any other final closing remarks as we finish up here?
Yeah, Jake, I might just, you know, build on what Jamie just was said. This is not for everybody. And this is not to say that what we're doing can't work, because it can and it does, right? I mean, if, you know, we have thousands of public companies and they all kind of pay the same. And so people are used to a paradigm. They're used to salary and bonus and LTI and annual grants of it, right? I mean, so changing a paradigm is never easy, but it can work in certain circumstances. Mm-hmm. And it certainly can and should be brought to the table as a consideration for how we can do things differently. We may not choose to embark upon that. We may say that right now we don't have the right management team for it. We may say this is not the right time in the company's life cycle to do it. But to not have this type of conversation and just to kind of keep doing what we've always been doing and assuming that's the only way, that's where we're trying to challenge that paradigm. So, you know, like everything, Jamie and I know are proud that our clients don't have the same programs. They do use different metrics. They do have different pay mixes. They do use different vehicles. And this is just yet another tool in that toolbox of conversation to say, what makes your organization special? And could this work for your company, your management team, your board, and ultimately your shareholders?
Thank you both for taking the time on this. This was phenomenal.
Thanks very much, Jake. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Jake.
This episode is brought to you by Meridian Compensation Partners. Meridian works with compensation committees to ensure the most effective processes are in place to go beyond mere compliance with governance requirements and create healthy, dynamic relationships between the board, management, and its advisors. Meridian helps boards use compensation to attract and retain critical talent and to make informed business decisions that will link pay and performance, drive business results, increase shareholder value, and mitigate potential risks. Learn more at meridiancp.com. Thank you for listening, and we hope you enjoyed this episode of the Executive Compensation Podcast. You can see more about this episode along with additional executive compensation insights at meridiancp.com. That's Meridian, the letter C and the letter P.com.